Okay, the recorder's on, and this is World Affairs Monthly, and I have Mr. Marvin Weinbaum on the line. He's widely regarded as one of the U.S. government's leading experts on Afghanistan and Pakistan. Of course, you know, there's many experts, but he's probably considered one of the finest. He was born in 1935, so obviously he's been around a long time. He's 88 years old. He worked as a professor of political science at University of Illinois from 1965 to 1998. Then he went over to Washington and worked at the Bureau of Intelligence and Research at the State Department from 1999 to 2003. Pretty cool time to be there, I would imagine. And now he's been, ever since 2003, he's been a scholar in residence there in Washington, D.C. at the Middle East Institute. And, of course, he's got a bachelor's of arts degree. It just, you know, he's not a household name, so I'll just go into his biographical info here. He's got a bachelor of arts degree in Brooklyn College. And from 1958 to 1961, he did his PhD at Columbia University. And, of course, I was born in 1958, so we know what's going on here. The Middle East Institute is a pretty well-known and actually quite famous institution there in Washington, founded in 1946. Dedicated to the study of the Middle East. And the Middle East Institute, of course, can be found on the net at mei.org. Great to talk to you. Indeed, an honor to talk to you, Marvin.
Now, nice to talk to you.
Yeah. I'm thinking that, you know, I sent you those four topics, and I'm going to read the first one here. But I, you know, it's really amazing to realize that, you know, there's a lot of things going on out there in the world. And the other day I was looking up, you know, preparing for this interview, I punched in the search engine, British invasion of Afghanistan. And up comes this website from the British Army Museum, I think it was. And here I quote them: between 1839 and 1842, British Imperial forces fought a bitter war in Afghanistan. Initially successful, the campaign ended with Britain withdrawing from the country, having suffered one of the worst military disasters in the 19th century. So I said to myself, well, you know, everybody's been talking about this for a long time, of course, ever since we retreated from Afghanistan. But we did go in there thinking we had to go in there, and we basically, you know, we didn't get wiped out like the British did, but kind of give me an idea what you were thinking back then, you know, say 1999, you know, before the war began, before 9/11, and compare and contrast that with what you're thinking now. I mean, you know, that would be really cool. So I hope you're doing well, by the way.
Thank you. Well, let me go back briefly in history.
Yeah.
Actually, they fought a second war, and all of the troops, pretty much except for the officers, were Indian troops.
Mm-hmm.
The British, as such, suffered a defeat more to its honor.
Okay.
It had enormous stakes in the subcontinent. After all, India was a cash cow for them.
Yeah.
And they wanted very much to hold on to it. The Russians were interested in, the Tsarist Russia was interested in getting them out of there.
Mm-hmm.
and they were always very sensitive to any encroachment there in what they considered was their protected area.
Mm-hmm.
Which extended into what is now Afghanistan. So I just want to suggest here, this was a very unusual situation. It was a disaster because it really hurt their pride.
Mm-hmm.
As much as anything. They got totally wiped out except
yeah.
for one person.
Right.
One person who survived to tell the tale.
That's amazing. And
they also suffered a similar defeat. But even though they lost, they continued to control the area and its foreign policy.
Okay.
So they lost, but they were back in there in a few years later, effectively.
I see.
They didn't want to stay there. Well, who would want to stay? The place had no resources. It didn't have cotton. It didn't have opium.
Yeah.
And that's really what mattered.
Okay. So now, what would you say regarding our attempt to kind of get in there?
Okay.
Yeah.
Right. Let me address that.
Yeah.
I can give you on good account the fact that we were not interested in regime change.
Okay.
Again, no reason to. We had other fish to fry, certainly.
Yeah.
We had what happened with 9/11 was that there was a focus here very clearly on Osama bin Laden to get him.
Yeah.
We put sanctions on earlier. It really started more with the bombings that took place in Africa, mm-hmm. where Al-Qaeda was identified as having been involved in attacks on two American embassies in Afghanistan. So from that point on, we were out to get Osama bin Laden.
Right.
We let the Afghan Taliban know very clearly that we wanted him and his immediate entourage turned over.
Mm.
That was the issue.
Okay.
And nothing else. Who would want to inherit the regime of Afghanistan?
Yeah.
It was not of our interest. The Pakistanis had other views.
Mm-hmm.
They saw this as, an extended geographic area which would give them perhaps some advantage in facing India.
Mm-hmm.
They called it, gain strategic depth. They
referred to
it
in
that way. So, but with 9/11 and the linkage here again to Al-Qaeda, it was full time now, get Osama bin Laden. And Thomas, until the last minute, we gave Mullah Omar, who we didn't like, and we didn't like what they were doing in the country. I was there as a professor for a brief time in 1998.
Really?
And it was the place was dead.
Yeah.
It was a ghost town.
Yeah.
Everything that was going on there to keep the country going was being done by CARE, Save the Children, and International Rescue Committee. It was the NGOs and the several of the Islamic charities. That's what kept the place going.
Right.
It was nobody wanted to have this place or would certainly want to have.
Okay.
But okay. So
I got you. So there was no imperial interest in
No, there was nothing. Now we went in.
There's something going on with a phone, but okay. Are you there?
Yeah, right. Okay. We went in as we did, and this was understood in the region. The United States suffered a great defeat, and it was payback time.
Yeah.
And we gave them ample warning that we were going to come in. Again, another chance to turn over. And we used the Pakistanis as emissaries.
Sure.
We didn't have any direct contact with the leadership, Mullah Omar above all.
Okay.
We didn't have that. So, and he didn't budge on this, even though he knew at that point that Osama bin Laden was a liability. But there were other, he had taken, you can give tribal and religious reasons for protecting the stranger and all that.
Mm-hmm.
You can throw that in there, but he didn't do it. So we attacked. We went in then with the idea, we'll put in a government.
Having trouble with the phone again. I don't know.
Yeah. I don't know what the problem is.
Yeah. A little suspicious.
And we thought we would go in together with the other countries.
Uh-huh.
And we had a meeting in Bonn. And the Russians were there. The Iranians were there.
Mm.
And all of the Mujahideen who had been fighting, everybody was there. And the idea was to go in, establish a government,
mm-hmm.
Set up the framework for a new government, appoint Hamid Karzai as president.
Mm-hmm.
And that couldn't have been done without the Russians and the Iranians. They really made that work.
I see.
So together we put it. And then we discovered just what the Russians had discovered after 1979. That once you go in, you own it.
Yeah, you exactly. You own it.
You can't The fear is, look, if we leave now, we're just going to go back to where things were.
Right, right. Okay.
Al-Qaeda is going to be back in. We didn't have Islamic State at that time.
Sure.
And so we just found it. And I was there early after the, in 2000. And there wasn't yet a serious insurgency from the Taliban. They were regrouping.
Yeah.
But by 2005 and 6, there really was.
I see.
And at that point, we were stuck there.
We were stuck,
because this regime could not defend itself.
Right. So that makes sense. You know, so we just figured, well, we got to keep it going for a little while because, you know, we can't just run away now, right?
And we didn't, perhaps if we pulled out then and put a lot of money into building up, but they weren't ready for a full-fledged army. They didn't come till later. But we were slow in doing it anyway.
Right.
And that took a real cost.
Okay.
And the Afghans themselves could not agree among, you know, the problem as much as we were the problem, they were the problem too.
Sure.
They were constantly fighting among themselves. The Mujahideen fought among themselves.
Mm-hmm.
And this new regime, and with a lot of money flushed in there, corruption obviously became a major item, and we found ourselves digging the hole deeper and deeper. Obama wanted to get out, announced that, you know, shortly after his coming to office.
Yeah.
But and he wanted to get out by 14.
Right.
And turned it over to their army.
Okay.
But even then, it didn't work.
Right.
Okay.
Well, once you're committed like that, right? I mean, it's going to be very difficult. Exactly.
And then what you do is, in Vietnam here, you pour more and more resources in. You figure, well, we're going to break the back, but you're fighting a guerrilla warfare.
Yeah.
Which on that turf particularly would be very difficult.
Right,
The rule of thumb here is you need 20 of your group, 20 of your fighters to every one of them, if you're gonna, and it worked in Malaysia, but I don't know where anywhere else.
Mm-hmm. Well, the critics will say, you know, we shouldn't be doing nation building, right? Is it, you know, but you're suggesting the argument's a little bit more nuanced.
Let me just say this.
Yeah.
It was never about nation building. Nation is identity.
Yeah.
It was about state building.
Sure. Okay.
It was about putting in place institutions, which they didn't have.
Yeah.
They had no institutions
right.
to start with.
Okay.
You had to create institutions, and for that takes decades to do.
Centuries.
Centuries. But nationhood is something else. It's, do you feel yourself an Afghan?
Right.
And on that score, they all did. It's interesting. There's never been a separatist movement in Afghanistan, where the Tajiks or the Uzbeks, who've got cousins across the border, said, we want to join them. Nor did the Pashtuns want to join Pakistan, nor the Baluch, Iran. So it was, they had this, and they have today, a sense of nationhood, but institutions were just non-existent.
Well, one of the poorest countries in the world, right? Per capita GDP.
Absolutely.
I don't think you could build much from that. I mean, it's going to be tough.
Yeah, look, I lived in Afghanistan in the early 1970s, again, as a professor.
Right.
It was a sad place.
Yeah.
It was peaceful, but it really was so poor that, again, they could not manage without the aid at that point in time, but given by two countries.
Mm-hmm.
Soviet Union and the United States. It wasn't a lot of aid money, but it was enough just to keep that place essentially going as a modern state.
Mm-hmm. Well, I noted also, I think I've known this for a long time, but I looked it up recently. The population in 1990 was about 10 million. And of course, now it's 40 million. So it's quadrupled in 30 years. That's quite astonishing, right? What would you say about that?
Yeah, they never had a census, not a proper census.
Okay.
You know, I wrote the the entry in the Encyclopedia Britannica, and I had to estimate the population.
I see.
So
you're saying that's not necessarily accurate?
No, because I can tell you, I made up the figure.
Okay. Okay.
What I did was...
Talking to the right guy. Yeah.
And this was about 2003 that I wrote that. And what I did was I took all of the guesstimates and I averaged them.
Okay.
And that's how I got 15 million. And even today, you see anywhere between 35 and 42 million figure given. They don't really know.
Okay. What would be, frankly, I guess that's correct. You don't really know. But what would you guess? Your experience?
Oh, it's an enormous
number. Enormous number, yeah. Okay.
The people coming back who have, again, Kabul was a dead city.
Yeah.
Maybe half of the people in Kabul had fled, mostly to Pakistan, some to Iran, some elsewhere.
Okay.
They came back, and the birth rate there is among the highest in the world.
Right.
So there you go. Yeah. We've had more than 20 years, and it just mushroomed. And now you got the infant mortality dropped.
Yeah.
So that you had the natural growth. And people lived longer,
right?
Because the average age was 46.
Yeah,
between 46 and 50.
So the average family is like 4, 5, 6 children, probably.
Yes, yes.
Yeah. Okay. Now, you finished with number one there. You want to? Number two. Now it's these things are always ironic. You know, we're there for 20 years, and I agree with everything you say. You know, I'm not going to challenge that. I think you're right. We were there for 20 years, and we didn't try to really do anything. We were just maybe trying to help them. Actually, frankly, we were trying to help them, and now we have this situation where we blew $1 trillion on this. But frankly, maybe the situation's pretty good, potentially good right now. I say here at number two, I've not talked to the Taliban leaders nor to the Pakistan leaders, but I'm pretty confident that both Afghanistan and Pakistan are realizing that they need to get serious, get really serious, embark on an economic development program, whatever you want to call it, for both countries. And the Russian government and Chinese government probably agree with me. And so maybe Central Asia, I should say Central Asia, you were there in the 70s, really cool. You know, it's a conduit between East and West, right? It's the main, it's a cool place. I've been there too. And so what would you say to this possibility?
Okay. Look. First of all, the 20 years weren't a total disaster.
Right.
What happened what we would call development of infrastructure and so on, some took place. It's not that all of the money went into the military.
Right, of course.
Because the military needed an infrastructure, if nothing else.
Yeah.
And so there was the beginnings of some manufacturing, but really on a very low scale. Not enough money was put into agriculture.
Right, okay.
Because there was the potential.
I see.
Yes, there are natural resources, but it'll take generations to really make that profitable.
Yeah.
So we did. But above all, what we created, because I was following it now over these last 23 years, I could compare it with the way it was in the 90s and all the way back to the early 70s when I got there first in 1970. And what I can say is what did happen in those 20 years was in some ways remarkable. The birth rate didn't decline, but the infant mortality dropped sharply. People were getting medical services they never got before.
Sure.
But above all, they developed human capital, which hadn't existed before. Because a lot of the refugees who came back now with education.
Okay.
Came back with ambitions. And so you went from three universities to, I don't know, 50 of them. I wouldn't call some of them real universities.
Yeah, yeah. Well, they're building, yeah.
But this was really the great tragedy there, because a lot of people came there. Now we're talking about millions of people who came and were during that 20 years, and what they they had gotten here was an investment in this country.
Right.
As dangerous a place as it was,
okay.
as much of a failure it was, the way they had an investment. And these are the people who would have, over a period of time, made this into a more modern and
a
wealthier society.
Yeah, they're the new foundation. Yeah.
They were. Yeah. Now, they're all gone.
They're all gone, yeah.
By and large,
yeah.
those are the people who have
okay.
left.
Okay.
And there are many others also who can't leave.
Right, right.
But are unemployed, and I hear horrendous stories about, or hiding.
Sure.
Fearful,
obviously.
Fearful.
Yeah.
But what it didn't have was it didn't bring peace.
Right.
And that ultimately was crucial here. Because when it comes down to the bottom line here, what people want to do is have physical security.
Yeah.
And to be able also to feed their family at the same time.
Yeah.
The wealth was not well distributed, but you know,
yeah.
When is it ever?
This was
the situation. So we can't write it off.
Yeah.
Except that now all that is gone. The Taliban are really this is now an ideological state, but I could get into that, but I won't.
No, you can. You can. Please. By the way, let me make a quick ask you a quick question about the literacy there in Afghanistan. In the 70s, what was it approximately, and what is it now?
Oh, well, look, what happened was the kind of growth that I'm talking about occurred largely in the urban areas.
Yes.
Now, those urban areas expanded enormously. Mm. So it wasn't just Kabul and Kandahar and Herat and Mazar-e-Sharif, which are the largest cities, but there was developing an urban society as well as a rural society, which is still overwhelmingly. Literacy, of course, increased. I sat in Afghanistan now after 2000, I think, in one classroom or a number of classrooms in 2012.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, honestly, I cried.
Yeah.
These were young children, and I've never seen children so avid about learning.
Yeah.
I don't take, fortunately, I don't have...
You're having trouble
much
with
of
the phone
but
again.
I was honestly...
Marvin, we're having trouble with the phone again. Are you doing something, or I don't know?
No, I'm not here. I'm trying to figure out why that's the case.
Yeah, no, I don't know. It could be conspiracy. Go ahead.
Is that any better?
No, it's good. It's okay. I'm just worried about it. But yeah, I worry about everything. I'm sorry to interrupt. Yeah, you were really on the verge of crying because you saw these young children.
I had never seen anything like this, and I'm not an easy crier.
Yeah,
it's true.
Okay.
I was amazed at myself.
Right.
That it brought tears to my eyes
to
see these children. They were separated. There were boys and girls in separate classes.
Yeah.
And these were, interestingly, this was done by an NGO that I was familiar with. They took them off the streets, and they put them for a portion of the day into classes, and they fed them.
Mm-hmm.
So these were the children who were selling cigarettes on the street.
Yeah.
And who were begging.
Okay.
It's really, really
fascinating. Yeah, yeah.
Experience. Yeah. Yes.
Well,
so,
we're talking extreme poverty, right?
Yeah.
Basically.
I don't have it. People were not starving. That was certainly the case.
Sure.
People were not starving. The economy was limping along.
Yeah.
And some people were getting super wealthy in the process. But again, there was a failure here to have security.
Mm-hmm.
And ultimately, this is what the Taliban capitalized on, that they were going to bring peace, and they were going to do it as an Islamic peace, which could take care of all of their problems.
Right.
And that, you know, that combination here of the failings of the government, the mistaken policies of the United States and others, and and the appeal of the Taliban really as an authentic force, which they weren't really, because the kind of Islam that the Taliban brings to Afghanistan is far more rigid. It's Wahhabi.
Yeah. Well, I mentioned Wahhabi. That. Yeah, I was going to say.
It's a blend of Wahhabi and Diobandi. Which is a similarly rigid, historically oriented, very conservative in terms of its social policies. And the Wahhabi influences became very pronounced during the 90s and then later. So what I'm getting at here is that one can't look for simple answers here. And what we have to avoid always is sloganeering.
Sure.
We have to avoid throwing, saying it's all the fault of this or that.
Yeah, yeah. No question.
Were it only so simple, I think we wouldn't need professors.
Well, you're right. You're absolutely correct. It's very complex,
and it is.
Yeah,
it is.
If you have your granddaughter next to you and trying to explain that to her, I'm joking around here. Maybe you have a granddaughter. She's gonna look at you cross-eyed. She's gonna say, "What the hell, granddad?"
Well, I'd be happy if either of them did. But my grandchildren, my sons, my grandsons, right?
Yeah.
Are very tuned. They're in college.
Okay. Well, I'm simply suggesting that, probably even though we spent 20 years there, most people on the street of New York City or anywhere in the United States may not even be able to point out Afghanistan on the map.
Well, it certainly was the case. I think probably there are a lot fewer now, but I guess.
Yeah,
of course. The point is well taken.
Yeah,
but they don't, because the same people don't know anything about American politics either.
Right. Yeah. Well, no. So, what about my question? That it's great to hear your views on that. I'm just saying that, are we poised for this tragedy? In a way, it's like a blessing in disguise in some ways. Very complex. But is this tragedy behind us? Do you think we're going to move ahead?
No. The situation in Afghanistan today is tragic.
Yeah.
Why? Because what was keeping the state going, the institutions that they had, was money from abroad.
Yeah. Okay. Fine.
Making up 2/3 of all of their income.
Right.
Now, the Taliban come in, that money comes out, and it only has gone back in that the U.S. is spending here more than any other country for humanitarian purposes.
Okay.
To basically to feed them.
Right.
The U.S. has no presence on the ground, whether political figures, we have no political representatives on the ground, or even in the relief organizations. This is all done through them and the U.N.
Okay.
So we, maybe it's out of a sense of guilt, I don't know, but we in the United States are really paying to keep them from starving, because the feeling was a year and a half ago that very well you could have a massive starvation now.
Yeah.
And it hasn't happened, but at the same time, this has been a very rough winter.
Okay.
And people are dying. And yes, young children aren't getting enough food. But the worst case scenario has not come about. And it's all because of the international community here and international organizations, which are being funded by countries.
Okay.
But it's a tragedy now because there are no jobs.
Yeah, so it's pretty grim. If you and I went there tomorrow, it's grim, right?
It's really sad.
Yeah.
And in that sense, the one thing that they have now that they didn't have then is, again, you can walk around there now.
Oh, sure.
You can travel there now, which is something I could do in 1997, but could not do very easily after that.
Yeah, okay.
That's the big difference.
So that's what the Taliban has achieved,
Right. Okay. And how much people, that will be enough is the big question here, because after they get that, then they say, well, I don't want to live like this.
Yeah.
I've got no hope here.
Right.
There's no future for me. And that's why the Taliban have to keep a rather repressive system going.
Yeah.
Because if they let go, they're going to be demonstrations. There have been some, and they've closed them down.
Yeah.
So they're going to have a pretty tight grip on things.
Right.
And stay unified, because if they're not unified, then the place is going to break into civil war, and the worst outcome for Afghanistan now is still out there, and that is that the Taliban fall apart,
okay,
and there's no government, and what you have is a free-for-all among all the various factions, ethnic groups, regional groups, ethnic groups, religious groups, and the worst time in the history of Afghanistan was between 1992 and 96, when before the Taliban came in and the Mujahideen government was ruling after the communist government failed, and failed because the Soviet Union stopped existing, and then they were not getting any support.
Yeah.
But they could not, that period of time was total anarchy.
Yeah, okay.
And they... you get the picture.
So the literacy, just to quickly ask you, you're suggesting that there was pretty good literacy in the cities, but most of the population...
There never was much literacy. No.
Okay.
I'd say guessing 80% of the population could not read.
Yeah. So isn't that, Marvin, you know, between you and I, of course, so we're talking to a global audience here, isn't this the fundamental issue? Because if you can't really communicate ideas and information to the public, you know, to the people, you're going to be, the best word is hamstrung, right? Tough.
But you see, they can't read the newspaper, but they can hear the radio.
They can.
And that, and one of the things that happened in that 20 years was they never had a phone system that worked.
Okay.
To get any outside call, you had to place a call to India and then have a connection to Europe, to the United States.
It's
crazy.
I see.
But what happened in 20 years, it coincided with the development of the smartphone.
You got it before I did. Yeah. So now we have the phone, right?
Yeah. Even in the rural areas.
Right.
And you put a SIM card in. And everything is pretty inexpensive.
Yeah.
The great number of people, certainly urban and rural areas too, now can communicate.
That's right.
And
they're learning to read.
So, that's on hold. The boys' schools, boys' schools are still there. But what's happening now is the Taliban have taken the curriculum, and they've turned it from a secular curriculum now into a largely Islamic curriculum.
Okay.
So how much they're really learning that's of value in terms of an income, that's another
matter. I see. So you have one large madrasa, maybe the audience knows that word, that's the religious school that the Taliban set up in the 90s?
No, I'm talking about now.
Oh, okay, now.
The normal schools, the girls have been thrown out of the university and secondary school. They're still... primary schools for girls. You know, they get enough that they can read a sign, and they can't progress on beyond sixth grade, say.
Okay. But you are suggesting, Marvin, that now with the telephone and satellites and internet, we're looking at a potentially very promising situation, even though
can use that to educate people, but you can all use that to manipulate people's views through propaganda.
Okay.
So it can cut both ways.
Okay, cut both ways. Okay. So you're not, basically, if you and I had coffee tomorrow in Washington, D.C., and you wanted to predict the future, I asked you to predict, you would not say very promising things?
I'd say what I've said to numerous people who have asked that question.
Yeah.
I'd say, unfortunately, the best we can hope for is that something like what we have today is there 5 years from now.
I
because
see.
The alternatives,
yeah.
The alternatives are worse.
Okay.
So now, we're in the unusual position of disliking and much of the international community.
Right.
And of course, they're bored. Right. Iran, Russia, India, everybody is appalled by this regime.
I see.
But everyone, nobody is going to help a resistance force at this point in time because they realize that the potential for that is limited. The resistance movement could never agree among itself. Mm-hmm. And so we're better off with seeing some kind of stability here. So at least we have some ability to work in the country, mm-hmm. because if they start fighting, then even the basic kind of relief is not going to be available.
Okay.
So the international community is pretty much in agreement.
Okay.
Here, we're going to have to live with this regime. They're growing poppy again, despite promises they weren't.
Mm-hmm.
They're not the jihadi groups that are likely to move on Pakistan and Uzbekistan, Tajikistan, Iran. Those groups are still being given assistance in the country.
Mm-hmm.
All of this, but the alternative is a brutal civil war.
And do you think that's something that's quite probable, or, you know, if you had to take a guess?
As long as the Taliban hang together and are able to exercise some kind of order, as I say, we'll probably see an extension of what we have now.
Okay.
I don't see any external forces coming in to change that. There may be some incremental gains that they can make, but most of their income now is entirely from collecting tariffs and from what they can get off the smuggling trade.
Okay. Say that the opium cultivation is ongoing and they're not...
Yeah, it really is. They outlawed it, but all the indications are its production is higher than ever.
Okay.
Or as high
really,
as ever.
Really. Now, do you think it's a mistake, Marvin, that we're not reengaging
it is. I've just written a book chapter, which I sent off today.
Really? Yeah.
In which I argue the U.S. has to reengage.
Oh, I think we should. And I was so happy when I got your email. I said, hey, great. I absolutely agree. We have to reengage.
We have to reengage because... it's the only way, for our own sake as well as theirs.
Yes.
We can. Now, the trouble is that it's not going to be easy.
Well, no.
They've got a leadership there now, which is split between two shoras, I call them.
Okay.
Councils. One in Kandahar and the other in Kabul. The one in Kabul is more outward looking.
Mm-hmm.
I wouldn't call them progressive.
Yeah.
But
okay.
They are more sensitive and are willing to be more flexible on the women's issues, example.
Mm-hmm.
The one right now in Kabul is made up of a body of clerics who have their own sense about what an authentic Islamic State is all about.
Mm-hmm.
And that is the narrowest. It's narrower than the Wahhabis.
Mm-hmm. Wow.
The real contrast to Saudi Arabia and just about any other place.
Mm-hmm.
It's in their head, they think that they have the formula.
I see,
And it's really a crime because this is retarding, and you've got a supreme leader here who doesn't meet with anyone.
Right.
And that group, you go to Kandahar, you can't get close to the people who really have power. So yes, you want to be engaged, you want to be on the ground.
Oh, definitely. Yeah.
I've been arguing this for a long time.
Yeah. That's
in
great.
Articles and as I say elsewhere, we've got to get back into it.
Oh yeah, I'm totally in favor of that. I think you're absolutely correct. Now why is it that our pride that's the Europeans and what's going on? What's the reason for not considering re-engagement?
Yeah, if the U.S. has a particular problem here because what you're living with is a political system which both parties, which may very well interpret any kind of overture as an overture, which we're not really making here.
Okay.
treat this as somehow making concession, somehow approving of what they're doing.
Oh yeah, not the case.
This is a problem. So it's going to be politically difficult. We also have security requirements, so that putting people on the ground there, mm-hmm. It's going to be difficult. Other countries seem to worry less about that. Mm-hmm. So it's not going to come easily.
Because, you know, I think before I turned on the recorder, I mentioned this definition of diplomacy, right? And I'll read it again. I redefine diplomacy. Interstate relations being necessary, compel heads of state to undertake studies, investigations, research on what is going on in the neighboring realms and regions to all over the world, prepare for war. So we need to understand, right? Am I correct or not?
Well, look, no. No, because if they serve any purpose, it's to avoid...
That's what I'm saying.
They don't need the other side. They can do that unilaterally.
Yeah. No.
If they want to avoid conflict, then they got to talk. There's no substitute for that.
Well, it's a clumsy way to put it. I wanted to say avoid war, but you know, I'm just
okay.
Yeah,
okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
No, I'm clumsy. Yeah.
I got you.
Okay. So now, don't you agree with me that, you know, you said you may not agree with everything? By the way, I think it's fabulous that we don't agree on everything, but we largely agree. Now, do you think it's possible that once we reengage, and if we do, and we do, say we do, this is going to turn out pretty promising after 20, 30 years?
I wouldn't put any money on it.
Really?
I think we have to do it as a minimal kind of
exercise
here, so that we don't miss on opportunities. For example, we're not going to agree on because of their ideological and our own ideology.
Yeah. Yeah.
We're not going to agree.
Right.
Nor will a lot of other countries, which may care less about it because we make a fetish of some of our business. Okay. Mm-hmm. So we're not going to do that. But what we want to do is to find those areas of common interest.
Right.
And we can't do that unless we are in communication. Mm-hmm. And the engagement here means simply that we want to learn more about who they are. They should know more about who we are. Mm-hmm. And maybe we can make progress.
Oh, yeah. I think we can.
We can find out we have more in common, and we do have. Neither of us really is that much in favor of Islamic State, for example.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
because
that's right.
They view that. So we have some counterterrorism. We have in common the fact that we both want to save people from starving.
Right.
And we want, you know, right now the U.S. has turned over, but not directly. It's turned over $3.5 billion that was held. It was frozen in New York banks.
Oh, yeah.
To a foundation in Switzerland. Mm-hmm. Well, unfortunately, they haven't spent any of that money. Mm-hmm. And now, given a court decision yesterday, federal court decision, and that will be appealed, but nevertheless, it was important. The remaining $3.5 billion that the families of 9/11 victims wanted to be able to divvy up, as the court has said, no, that's not your money.
Okay.
That's not your money. And so now that's up in the air. And here Biden did what I didn't think at the time was a good idea. In order, I think that they thought this is the way the courts were eventually going to go. Mm. And so he pulled out of the seven, he pulled out 3.5 and he stashed, he gave that over a promise to this Swiss, which is where there are representatives from Afghanistan, the United States, and other countries. That could make a real difference. If we could put all that $7 billion, and there's another $2 billion out there, $9
billion. Right.
The problem is that how you get it to the people who need it without giving it simply and throwing it into the coffers of the Taliban to do what they want with.
Right.
That would never play.
Right.
That wouldn't play.
Yeah.
So that's where we are. But that could make an enormous difference
now.
in stabilizing the economy. And by and large, the economy compared, you know, there's no inflation to compare with what's going on in Pakistan. In that sense, Afghanistan looks much better.
I see, yeah.
Now
we're going on. Let's see. I think about 40 minutes. I know you didn't want to talk too long.
Yeah, I know.
It's okay. We're at 45 minutes. I got two more big questions here. But if you want to give it a go in a couple of weeks, do a second part or whatever. It's
okay,
up to you.
Go ahead.
So the third question is, you know, we have these religious ideas. We're talking about this. You know, the religious fervor, right, that's taken hold. It's been there for a long time. The Wahhabi, Deobandi, you know, it's from the Arabian desert. Now, this has caused a lot of problem, obviously. But on the other hand, maybe it's kind of fading. I don't know. I'm thinking it might be fading.
I wish that were the case. What I said before, that this kind of thinking is really alien to the Afghan culture.
Yeah.
Now, why? Because the Afghan culture, religion, was rather relaxed.
Yeah.
Yeah, people observed Ramadan, or Ramazan, as they call it. They observed that. But, you know, as long as you didn't eat openly, they didn't care what you did behind the curtains.
I see. Yeah.
And most people, and you could go around the country and see this, most people were closer to the Sufi tradition mm-hmm. of Islam, which is more mystical. It's less rigid. Mm-hmm. You know, it doesn't have a problem with music. To the contrary, mm-hmm. whereas the current government, music is banned. Mm-hmm. Any form of music is banned. Even today, the Afghans chafe under this kind of regime, the rigidity of this kind of regime. It's really not bedded in their culture. Now you're getting a new culture emerging from this, mm-hmm. and so the next generation may see things very differently. But
I guess what I'm suggesting is that, you know, they're so poor in the world, you know, there's a lot of still very poor people in the world. And aren't people realizing that this kind of poverty is just basically intolerable? You know, you got to do something about it.
Yeah, but how do you, the country really will always be dependent for the longest time. It doesn't have the resources. It doesn't have any railroads.
Yeah.
It has limited roads that are really, you know, that can be used.
Okay.
It's going to be on the dole for a long time.
Okay.
It cannot manage without. It's a dependent country,
right?
And but it had, as I was suggesting before, it had the potential here of developing a more modern economy,
mm-hmm.
and it's only a more modern economy that can provide
mm-hmm.
this kind of support, medical and agriculture, can put money into agriculture mm-hmm. and so on.
Now,
one thought here.
Yeah. Now,
the sad thing is that the Taliban, in their vision of Islam, see that maybe a modern economy is not necessary.
Mm-hmm.
After all, you know, if their head is stuck back in the 8th century or the 7th century,
mm-hmm.
You can live a good life without this. So
they want
aid, they want development, but they're not on that. As they see it, we're not going to give an inch in terms of compromising on what we consider to be a core Islamic value.
I see. Huh.
But they want those things. Yeah. They want political recognition. They want a lot of money spent on the country, such as the previous government was getting. They want all of that, mm-hmm. but they want it on their terms.
Okay. Huh. Now, in the 70s, you would have been shocked if I told you we got a crystal ball and this is the future of Afghanistan?
Out of my pants. Yes.
Well, yeah, no, you would have been appalled.
Appalled? I would have been shocked. Well, look.
I mean, what would be your reaction?
It was pretty appalling. Then it was a political system was not working.
Yeah.
The country was very poor.
Yeah.
Much poorer than it is now.
Right.
Because there's been what's been left, and human capital and physical capital.
Yeah.
There that didn't exist. For example, there's now a road between. That connects most of the country.
Okay.
It wasn't really a usable.
Yeah. That's pretty cool.
Yeah. You know, so that kind of basic thing.
Right. Right.
Yeah, now the road's in bad shape, but at least it's secure, which was something it was not for a long time.
Okay. Well, if we reengage, I think my hunch is that, you know, it could turn out to be pretty good. But you know, you've been at this longer than I have.
We've got some impediments.
Yeah.
We've got constraints here.
We do.
On every side here.
Yeah.
So this is going to be difficult. And if you've got, important to say about the Taliban, they are not a normal state. Normal states, what you do is you squeeze them, you throw some bones to them.
Yeah.
And you find compromises.
Sure.
The Taliban don't compromise.
No, yeah, they're pretty steadfast,
In the negotiations and today, then we have a term for that. We call they're not transactional.
Okay, right.
They don't say, you give me this, I'll give you that.
Yeah.
They don't operate that way.
Right,
and
right.
It's taken us a long time to realize. We thought we could get a peace treaty that would somehow bring in a power-sharing government. They never wanted to share.
No, they didn't want that, Well, it's interesting. Now, if you think we're at 50 minutes. If you think you got more to say about everything, you know, in Pakistan,
and probably you do. I probably talked out for it.
Yeah, no, we can do it. We can do another one in a couple of weeks. We could talk about Pakistan. But look, I think
it's great
to talk to you, Marvin. And I'll email you, and we'll set up a second one.
Okay.
All right.
Fine. Okay.
Thanks so much. Appreciate it.
Okay.
Bye bye.
Sure. Okay. Bye bye.